Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we are back here for another week. Sadly, Jeff can't join us tonight, but Dennis Blocker is here, as he's always here, and we get another great show tonight, and this one's right up Dennis's alley, and we have a fantastic, fantastic guest who's an author and shares a passion for a particular segment of the war. Jeff and I have talked about this in the past. It's unexplainable. Everybody has that thing, and everybody finds that one little niche part that really interests them. They'll have interest in the entire history or at the hobby if they're a living historian, but then they focus on a particular thing, and we have another gentleman who's focusing on that thing. But I think it only makes sense to have Dennis introduce our guest tonight. So, Dennis, how are you today, sir?
Well, doing well.
Look
doing
at
great.
You.
I'm really excited about Zach being here with us tonight. We got a long history, and I'm excited for everybody. They're in for a treat tonight.
I'm excited about your new camera, your new microphone, your new internet connection. We are moving up in the world. So, without any further ado, Zach, how you doing, friend?
Doing very well. Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Big fan of the podcast.
Love the posters behind you, and I thank you for being the kind words you said about the podcast before we got into the show. You know, let's rewind a little bit, and let's go back kind of like the format we used to do back in the day before we get into the reason you're on the show tonight. Let's get the audience caught up with you. Where are you from? How did you get into the hobby or the passion of World War II and the steps that led you up to what you're doing today and the reason we have you on the show?
So, I originally from Michigan, have kind of lived all over the place.
I won't hold that against you.
But as far as the actual book and the story and everything about me, you could say that it all started back in 2011 with an interview with my grandpa, Steven Gansberger, who served in the United States Navy in World War II. And on May 18th, 2011, I was lucky enough to interview him for a couple hours on tape about his experiences in World War II aboard two different landing craft infantries, the LCI 329 and the LCI 65. And I learned a whole bunch of great stuff about what they even were. Had no idea what LCIs were when I spoke to him, but we had a great conversation, learned a lot of stuff. And that kind of got me on my journey because 2 days later, after I interviewed him on May 20th, 2011, he passed away. So I was very, very lucky to get the interview when I did.
Yeah.
And the wow. And that's kind of where the journey all started, because the more that I learned and the more that I, you know, talked to LCI veterans that I reached out to and spent 10 years, the book is a product of 10 years of work tracking down these guys, his shipmates and the guys from his flotilla group, and you know, publishing the book. And at each step along the way, it's been a terrific journey.
Do you still have those audio recordings?
I do. Yeah, I've been making YouTube videos lately about trying to splice in their interviews with you know, historical footage and things like that. So I do. I have a whole host of interviews that I'm trying to find stuff to do with.
Fantastic. And as always, we'll link to those on the website when this episode goes up. You know, a lot of us who have the privilege to interview World War II vets, very few of us have the privilege to interview a family member who is a World War II vet, to be of the age enough to actually think about it and then have the foresight to record it. Because, you know, particularly people from my generation, you know, our grandfathers were in the war and they didn't talk about it a lot. After Saving Private Ryan came out and some of the other series, then as their generation started to thin out a little bit, they finally realized, hey, it's no longer braggadocious to talk about this stuff, but more importantly, it's more important so that our friends who didn't come back from the war and those of us who are no longer with us can be remembered, and we can get these stories in print and recordings on record. But very few of us who had the opportunity to talk to our grandparents about it, either we didn't have the foresight, the technology, or even the happenstance to have the privilege and the ability to record it. You know, maybe you're sitting around at lunch at a fast food restaurant somewhere, you're sitting in traffic one day and it just comes up. But to be able to actually take the time, sit down and record it, and like you said, do it when you did, when as you didn't know it at the time, but this was your last chance to do it, you got to feel super privileged about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm so lucky that I was able to do it. And, you know, all the things that I learned just not only on that day, But, you know, immediately following it, it keeps coming back to that over the years. Every time, you know, that I have thoughts, questions, I wish I still could have asked them. It's, you know, it comes back to, wow, I was really, really lucky to get that story when I did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, clearly, we don't want to give everything away. We want people to buy the book. Absolutely. But just give us enough of a little bit, maybe a little bit of a hint of, was your grandfather enlisted prior to the happenings on Pearl Harbor? Did he enlist afterwards? Just give us maybe a few tidbits to hook us into going on running to Amazon and picking up that book.
Sure. So first and foremost, the book's title is called When the Beaches Trembled, the incredible true story of Steven Gansberger and the LCIs in World War II, right there.
That's an awesome cover.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So he was born in 1924, and he was 17 years old when Pearl Harbor was attacked. And his parents had a strict rule, was not allowed to enlist until he came of age. And at the time, he needed to be 18 to serve, unless you got signature from your parents, which he did not get. So he had to wait patiently. And so he enlisted in August of 1942, and he was destined to be assigned to the LCI 329 to begin with. And then later in the war, he was on the LCI 65. Now, a couple things for people listening. LCI stands for Landing Craft Infantry, and it was a amphibious flat-bottomed assault ship whose primary purpose in the beginning of the war was to deliver our troops during invasions to enemy-held beaches. And they were able to do that with their flat bottom, the way that they were designed. And so he got assigned to the LCI 329. And the main body of the book is his story. His journey in the South Pacific, he was assigned to LCI Flotilla 5. And they were at first assigned to Halsey in the South Pacific and the Solomon Islands. And then eventually he got assigned to the MacArthur's 7th Amphibious Force later on in the summer of 44. And it's an incredible story, just his. But I was lucky because I spent 10 years tracking down other guys to get their stories in the flotilla group. And I was the editor of the LCI Association's newsletter for a while. So I was able get a ton more stories. So really the book is his story in the South Pacific and the journey of Flotilla 5. But it's filled with all sorts of other stories from these guys that were relevant to the story that I'm telling, that are from all over the place. Everything from newsletters to books to newspaper articles to interviews that I did with these guys. And so it's filled with all those different types of stories.
Now, taking up that role as part of the administration of that group, did that come before or after you started, you know, tracking down guys and had the idea for your book?
So this is basically the whole story. So after the interview when my grandpa died, I really wanted to know more. I wanted to find out if he had any buddies or shipmates that were still alive. So I reached out to the LCI group, and I found out the Association for LCI Veterans at the time in 2011. I reached out to them, and they let me know that they were going to have a reunion in Charleston in 2012. And that year, it was a combined reunion between the LCI group and the LSM group, which stands for Landing Ship Medium. It was another type of amphibious assault ship that they used. It was a whole bunch in World War II. Audiences, you're going to be hearing a lot of acronyms today. so that's one of them. So I ended up getting involved and volunteering with the LCI Association, and this standout gentleman named John Comer, who was who was a veteran in Normandy in the LCI 502. He offered me a job as kind of to proofread the newsletter at first, and then that kind of turned into interviewing guys and writing their stories and articles. And then eventually, as John's health kind of deteriorated a little bit, he offered me the job to be the editor-in-chief. And so from 2014 to 2016, I was the editor-in-chief of that letter of that newsletter. And as I mentioned, that's where a lot of the different stories came. I was getting mail almost every day, you know, telling different stories from all over the place, from the Pacific to Europe. And so I got involved in that. And then eventually, because of that work, I got hired on as the editor-in-chief for the LST group's newsletter. Wow. The LST Scuttlebutt. And viewers out there, please don't get it confused. The What's the Scuttlebutt podcast is different than the LST Scuttlebutt, the newsletter. So not to be confused.
One could argue they had access to the name long before I did.
but so that's how I got involved. And because of all that information that I got, I just realized this really needs to be told in, first and foremost, a book. But I've been pushing, and so I know Dennis has too. I've been pushing for the longest time that they've got to pick a story from the LCI vets and tell it, because there's never been a story about LCIs in modern cinema, whether that's movies, whether that's TV shows or streaming services shows. There's never been a story about these guys, and everything that they did was just so incredible. And not a whole lot of, you know, everyday Americans have heard of what LCIs are, the landing craft infantry. And, you know, one of the purposes of the book is really to try to get the word out to, you know, hopefully see it on the big screen someday. And more than anything, tell these guys' stories, because they're stories that deserve to be told. And, you know, these are guys that deserve to be remembered.
I can imagine, you know, if you're have a passion for the subject and you have a desire to interview people, what a better way to do it than have access to the mailing list of the LCI newsletter. I mean, as Dennis can tell you, anybody who else have been on our show who's tried to interview vets, the hardest part is, obviously back then it's a little easier because, you know, the span of years has gone by, but just having tracking them down, knowing where to look, where to ask. And so to have access to that mail list probably simplified it a little bit, not to mention the fact that your grandfather was there and you had channels through relations of the people he served with. And so that probably made it a little easier as well. But
Got a
weird question for you, but these weird questions pop in my head when we do the show. We all know, or maybe we don't, a lot of us know that the Higgins boat was actually a pre-war invention that was designed to rescue hurricane victims in Florida and Louisiana. The LCIs, was that actually a pre-war design invention, or was that something that we had to rush to come up with to accommodate the new form of amphibious warfare that we're looking into?
So that's a very, very tricky, very complex question with a lot of history behind it. But again, to throw out some acronyms, so the Higgins boats, known as little LCVPs, you're right, those were invented before the war by a gentleman named Andrew Jackson Higgins down in New Orleans. And they became basically the most important, you know, first wave assault craft that we had. And those are really small, though. You know, people out there, the scene from Saving Private Ryan that people remember the most, because of just how epically dangerous it was to deliver troops like that in incoming machine gun fire. So those particular little Higgins boats, they were relatively small. They could fit about 30, 40 guys. But LCIs are a little bit different because they're a little bit bigger. They still have flat bottoms and everything, and they're not made of wood like a lot of the Higgins boats were made of. They were made of steel, and like cold rolled steel, but they weren't very thick. Bullets would a lot of times go right through them. But so as far as like the LCIs go, they were just one of a host of a different number of amphibious craft there was. Like Higgins boats, there was LCIs, there were LSTs, and they were developed right at the beginning of the war. Because I would say if I had to pick an event that really was the biggest contributor to why they got developed, not just the start of World War II, but really it all comes back to Dunkirk and the British. So the British were the ones that kind of, you could argue, started the amphibious force, or like started the amphibious warfare concept. They realized that, you know, in order to conquer Hitler, they'd have to basically develop these crafts to be able to hit the beach. They can't use the ports anymore because, you know, the Nazis controlled all the ports. So after Dunkirk, the British, you know, got to work, started building these, you know, amphibious ships. And just real quick time out, the amphibious warfare, for those who aren't familiar, it's just putting the two movements together, landing from the ocean and then fighting on land. That was amphibious warfare. So the British realized, you know, we need to develop these ships, and they couldn't do it alone. So they would send over different blueprints and designs and requests to the Navy Bureau of Ships to help them out. And that's kind of where LCIs and LSTs kind of got developed, because there was this brilliant guy named John C. Niedermeyer who had a hand in basically developing the LST, but he had a big hand in developing the LCIs as well. And so they came about because of the need, this huge need to be able to deliver troops to enemy-held beaches. And the LCIs got developed, and there was a lot of problems in the beginning, just like anything you do for the first time. But slowly but surely, the designs got better, their functions, you know, evolved. And by the end of the war, admirals and generals were singing their praises as far as their contribution to the war effort because of how important they were, not just invasions, but when they needed supplies delivered back and forth, you know, they used LCIs to deliver a lot of those materials.
Another weird question just popped in my head, because I never thought about it before, but particularly Higgins boats, but the LCIs as well, because they're flat bottom, tend to have, I would assume, be designed for more shallow water. Were those inboard or outboard props and motors on those?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Dennis, aren't those inboard? They weren't sticking out, but they had a covering sort of.
Yeah, they were inboard. Yeah, they had a shaft and turbines and Just like a regular ship. Yeah.
Correct, yeah.
But they had a built, they built a cage around it so that it would, scraping across the reef and whatnot, it the reef would grind against the cage and not the propellers.
Were they single engine, dual engine, quad engines? I'm sure the LCIs had huge engines, but it would also make sense for rules of redundancy, especially in military warfare. You know, if you have room for dual engine, you'd want to go that route. But these are all things I've never even considered, the inner workings of these crafts.
I believe it was four engines. Dennis, correct me if I'm wrong. Is it four on each side or was it four total? I can't.
I think
I
it
think it
was
was
four on each side.
four on each side.
So
Yeah,
four
it
per
was a four
prop.
engine. So yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and there were GM engines that they used.
And I would assume they were diesel.
Yes, correct.
Run
Hey,
on
Zach, I
time.
wanted to ask you, I what as kind of an illustration of the vastness of the Pacific. Our grandfathers never crossed paths, did they? LCI Flotilla 3 and LCI Flotilla 5.
No, they did not. So Dennis's grandpa served on the LCI 449, and his theater of war was the Central Pacific under Nimitz, correct? So they did the Marshall Islands, they did the Mariana Islands. I think some of them saw Peleliu, and then they darted up to Iwo Jima. So Dennis's was in the Central Pacific, and unfortunately, the 449 and their group, Flotilla 3, they never crossed paths with Flotilla 5 with my grandpa in the South Pacific because my grandpa, Stephen Gansberger, his primary mission was the Solomon Islands in the South Pacific, because really the South Pacific area was split into two major operations, if you will, one in the Solomon Islands and one in New Guinea, one under MacArthur, one under Halsey. And for those who've heard the term Operation Cartwheel, that's basically the Allied effort to try to capture and surround Rabaul, to neutralize the threat there. And Rabaul was a major Japanese airfield and port and base, that was too dangerous to just go and invade itself. So MacArthur designed this kind of cartwheel island hopping operation where eventually they met up at Rabaul and surrounded it. And that was their primary theater of war, was the South Pacific area and the Solomons up through New Georgia and Bougainville and, you know, the Green Islands until they surrounded Rabaul. And then right when that was wrapped up, they got transferred to MacArthur's 7th Navy, which that was eventually the Philippines. So unfortunately, no, to answer your question, they never did.
Got another logistical question because we know when it comes to infantry troops, you got divisions, battalions, platoons, squads. How many vessels make up a flotilla?
So it depends on the flotilla, but the general rule is there's 36 LCIs in a flotilla. They're basically those 36 ships are broken up into, I believe it's LCI groups or 12 in each one. So 12 times 3 is, 36. And then each of those 12, those groups are split off into two little divisions where there's 6 LCIs in each division, and then a group, and then the flotilla. So they usually traveled most commonly in groups is usually the 12 of them.
So the LCI Association, you have these gentlemen that are in their 80s, some of them in their 90s. When Zach and I first got on there, they were some of the guys were in their late 70s. So very sharp, cantankerous, hilarious. And when we showed up, us young guys, we infused this energy back into them, and they just absolutely adored us being there. And they saw that, especially with our drive and our goal of preserving the history, these fellas, it was a godsend for them because most a lot of World War II groups just kind of fade off into oblivion. And we, Zach and myself, John France, and a couple other younger folks, we determined that we were not going to let that happen. We were not going to let our guys go off. So, as you can imagine, I want to transport everybody in time with me and Zach. We show up at the LCI Association reunion, and we walk through the hotel lobby doors, and you see that. What
Is
is
that a
that?
kazoo? Is
That's
that one of Royal's
a kazoo.
kazoos?
That's one of Royal Wetzel's
I
kazoos.
still have mine too, wrapped up in the package.
So, Don, we would enter through the doors, and you would hear these kazoos. just ripping it up. And here are these guys, you know, these combat vets, and they're just going to town on these kazoos, playing songs and just laughing. And then we would walk in, and in particular into the bar area where they would all be sitting, and there would just be this roar of Zach Dennis, and you know, just oh, it was just. And I would say that, you know, personally, and I'll let you comment on this, Zach. I not only did we get to interview these guys, but we got to rub shoulders with them, and we got to spend amazing amounts of time, quality time with these guys, and on trips and sitting and hearing their darkest fears. And well, it was just something that I know for me. Zach, I'll let you speak on it, but it was just, I'm just forever grateful.
I'll never forget it. I'm so glad you brought it up, especially the kazoos, because I have to say this now. In my book, When the Beaches Trembled, the guy that Dennis is talking about just now, an old World War II veteran named Royal Wetzel, he served aboard the LCI-70, and he was in my grandpa's flotilla group, so they were at most of the battles together. And he was just the most colorful guy you could ever imagine. So he's one of the main characters in the book to talk about. And speaking of the kazoos, he earned himself a nickname called the King of Kazoos. And that's what everybody called him because every reunion, he's always blaring on the kazoo. And it's just that moment that we went to the reunion, that and the ceremony in Fredericksburg soon after that, in March of 2013, was a lot of fun. And Dennis is right. Like, a lot of the vets, all they have is each other, and once they're gone, they kind of fade out into the sunset. But they weren't used to really having, young people, not just like their kids' generation, but now their grandkids and their great grandkids are starting to come to the reunions. And most of us really want to volunteer. We really were anxious to not just get stories from friends and buddies, but like guys in general, just to see what their experience was like. Was it like my grandpa's story? What funny stories did they have with their buddies to kill boredom? And it was just, yeah. So those reunions were really great. And like Dennis said, you get to rub shoulders with these guys. A lot of these guys, before they passed away, I was lucky enough where I got to call some of these guys really good friends, especially Royal. And I'm gonna miss him terribly because he was one of my favorite ones that I met.
Now, I've got to ask on behalf of myself and the audience, what is the inside joke with the kazoos and the LCI organization that they would
It
have
was
these kazoos readily
just
available at these events? Was there
it
an
was
inside joke?
just It was just Royal's unique stamp. You know, it was his, there was no meaning behind it. It was just, it was a kind of a really cool little snapshot of a personality that you know would have been on the ship, and he would have been a prankster, and he would have been making people laugh even in the darkest times, because they did get hit by a kamikaze. Was that Lingayen Gulf, early January 44 or 45? Was it 44, 45?
45. So it was January
45,
5th,
yeah.
1945. My grandpa was right next to him when it happened. And he even, that's in the book too, that whole story, how they got kamikaze. He even made a comment of how bad he felt for the ones who jumped to the water.
That's got to be devastating. I mean, obviously, a kamikaze attack on any vessel is devastating, but an LCI is substantially smaller than, oh, I don't know, a flat top, you know, aircraft carrier. There's less area of boat to be on to give you distance from the impact. I mean, that has to be tremendously devastating to a smaller craft such as an LCI opposed to a destroyer or a battleship or a aircraft carrier.
That's exactly right. And this would be a great time to mention that one of the stories in the book was how my grandpa's second ship, the LCIG, the LCI gunboat 65, they got kamikazed at Lady Gulf in the first few days of the invasion. So it was October 24th, 1944. And like you were saying, just one of those basically scraping and crashing into, one of the guns in the LCI was enough to completely take off like a third of the ship. And completely wipe out the gun that was sitting there. Him as the gun, the Lester Eugene Aston was his name, and he was on the number 4 gun at the back starboard side of the ship. And a kamikaze came in there and got him. And he was one of my grandpa's best friends, and he was the cook aboard the ship. So to lose one of their cooks was, an extra painful thing to happen because there were only so many cooks on a small crew like an LCI. Because I'm not sure if I mentioned it, but LCIs only really had a crew of about a platoon size, like about anywhere from 24 to 60 sailors, depending on which one. So, to lose the one of the only guys that knows how to cook on the ship, it was tough.
Yeah, and a cook too is somebody who is every member of the crew is going to see every single day. And to have him just suddenly just taken out of their existence, that was would have left a big giant hole, very glaring hole.
What's the length of an LCI stem to stern?
So it's about 159 feet. It's like 158 and some change, like 158.3 or something. But so about 159 feet long, and it was only 23 feet wide. So not very big, both in length or width.
Well, to that point, I just did a quick Google search. The wingspan of a zero is 39 feet. So if that thing hit just right from wingtip to wingtip, 39 feet out of, what'd you, 100 and
159.
so 159, that's a huge footprint if that thing hit just right.
Oh yeah, and they got targeted all the same. A lot of history, will tell you that it's only the aircraft carriers and the battleships that got targeted, the big capital ships. And though that's mostly true, there were so many times where the amphibians got targeted. The guys on the beach, the guys offshore, one hospital LSTs bringing wounded aboard from invasions. They got targeted all the same because the Japanese, if they'd fly in groups of planes, they'd each pick out a target and go to it. So if they just happened to pick out an LCI that day, that they were going to get hit.
Yeah, and
And
they would.
they would use suicide boats as well, Okinawa, the 82. I know that like the 405, was it the 405 in Palau, they were they had a mine blown up under their stern by a swimmer, suicide swimmer. So they had guys on the mine in the Palau, they had locked down all these islands and kind of like a mini version of MacArthur and Nimitz island hopping. So they would bypass all these different islands in the Palaus and they would lock them down with these gunboats. And the guys were manning the rails 24/7 with rifles and Thompsons, and because of the swimmers. And they were aggressive and there were a lot of them. And they were successful. They were blowing up 396 and 404. Yeah.
Yeah, they almost blew up the 730. Speaking of the Palos, whoever out there in the public has seen the Pacific Episode 5, the ones that deal with Peleliu, that tells the story of the Marines that were on the land. Just offshore, there was a whole story of the LCIs, that were trying to help them take out pillboxes and things like that. And because they were so close to the island, like Dennis said, they would get kind of kamikaze swimmers where they would take these makeshift rafts and load them up with explosives. And in the middle of the night, when it's pitch black, they would get the bearing of their direction in the day and then swim out there or, raft out there in the middle of the night when it's pitch black and you can't see anything. And, they would try to blow the ship up. In this one case I read about in the Cincinnati by John H. Morrell, the LCI 730, they had like a handful of Japanese that had grappling hooks and they were trying to actually board the ship. Like they were actually trying to get in there and kill crew members. So it was, I mean, not only did you have bombs and torpedoes and kamikazes during the day, but once that sunset, they had to worry about suicide swimmers in the dark. So it was like really life on an LCI was terrifying, even after the initial invasion's over. So it's just they
Very,
had to do a
very
stunt.
gritty. It's very gritty. It's almost swashbuckling their version of the Navy's experience in World War II, isn't it? I mean,
That's a
a
great
lot
way
of
to
the
put it.
Navy is they would never even see land. They would never even see the Japanese. They would see aircraft every once in a while, but a lot of the cruisers, and unless they were shelling an island, but the LCIs, to your point, they're in there. They are grappling at Saipan. They were boarding half-submerged Japanese vessels and going through these ships, door to door, through these ships, clearing the rooms and having these gun battles. I mean, this is old school Navy,
Oh, yeah.
Mediterranean, like Jolly Roger, like boarding ships and clearing them because their Marines were taking sniper fire from behind from these half submerged ships. Just, it's a tremendous story. Absolutely tremendous story. The LCI gunboats. And to that point, Zach, where do you think, if you could rank like 1 to 20, let's say a naval experience in World War II. And I would say at the apex, you've got the aircraft carriers, right? And the battleships. Like, and then you go down and you've got, the cruisers and the destroyers and the flight wings. Like, where do you think the LCI experience as far as history ranks?
Honestly, and I'm not just saying this because, I'm in it so deep with LCI vets, but objectively speaking, it's definitely the amphibious guys on the bottom of the totem pole, and it's definitely the LCIs as far as which one. And there's, you know, obviously there's several reasons. I know you know several reasons for saying that, because, you know, they're flat bottoms. They were the smallest ocean-going ship that was allowed to cross the entire ocean on their own with permanent crews. You know, with their flat bottom, they felt every single wave. So there were so many intangibles of what made it so miserable, but like the seasickness of just moving, even in the calmest sea, there's been poems written by these vets of just how much the ship was shaking, even in calm waters. I mean, between the seasickness and just having to adapt to life without the bare necessities. And by that, I mean, these guys hardly had fresh water. They ran out of fuel all the time. Their equipment broke down all of the time. You know, their bathrooms were basically a slat of wood with a hole in it. They couldn't take freshwater showers. I mean, they had no laundry facilities. And you know, a lot of these guys developed anorexia because they just didn't have enough food on the ship. There's only so much space where they depended on the bigger guys, the bigger ships that you were referring to, that for all their supplies. So yes, I would definitely put at the very, very bottom of naval experience. I mean, like possibly maybe submarines would be tied with possibly the worst. But it's like even submarines, once they were done on their missions, usually they got to go back to land and, you know, get a night or two in a hotel maybe or something in Pearl Harbor. But it's like these LCIs, the Navy just completely expendable and, you know, completely written off. Like they hardly got liberty because the Navy's like, well, they're on ships. So, I mean, it's, they got to catch it. They're good. Right. And like, they just never give them a second thought when really they, so these guys spent like 2-3+ years on an LCI, and that sounds miserable. So yeah, definitely the bottom of Navy experiences, which makes it so incredible that what they did.
Two things, and you kind of touched on one that came up in my brain, but before I get to that, would it be fair to say when it comes to Navy, obviously taking the corpsmen out of the equation because they landed with the Marines and taking the frogmen out of the equation, when it came to Navy ship bearing cats, would it be safe to say that LCI guys were the closest thing to a Navy infantry? They were the ones closest to up the front face-to-face battle. And my following point to that, with the exception of the submarine, when it comes to, as you mentioned previously in the show, the lack of coverage and the lack of interest in Hollywood and pop culture, Navy overall, I mean, there's, if we think about it, if you take away the submarine-based movies, how many just plain Navy-based combat movies are there? Very few, because when people think Navy, and rightfully or wrongfully, they think, okay, aircraft carriers, dropping some depth charges and shooting, you know, ships 4 or 5 miles away. And so you don't have the intimacy and the suspense of that. Whereas Hollywood says, okay, if you're underwater in a tin can and you get hit, you're going to sink. There's your intimacy. There's your suspense. There's the drama. And maybe that's why they focus more on submarine movies. Whereas maybe that would be part of your elevator pitch when trying to get someone to pick up an LCI project. Like, look, these guys and everything you just went through, the hardships, the fact that they're running close to the shores, trying to take out batteries and getting hit by the kamikazes, the risk of the, when you were talking about, I was thinking of pirates, the Japanese pirates with the grappling hooks coming up over the edge,
yes,
and trying
absolutely
to come at them with swords. Yeah. And that whole thing, it just seems like it's, out of all of them, it seems like that is the closest thing you're going to get to a foot slogger on the ground.
That's exactly right. And if I had to say which one was the closest to, yeah, your everyday infantry, the roughnecks, it would definitely be the LCI guys. And I know Dennis knows this because Flotilla 3, his grandpa's group in particular, when they were at the Palo Islands, John H. Morrell was a captain of the LCI 730, and he was famous for
amazing character.
He's famous really for kind of, all to your point, what you're saying is he realized the importance of not only just knowing how to be an everyday sailor in the Navy, but these gun crews that had to protect the troops, they had to learn how to use those heavy guns that they were equipped with. And Morrell, this captain, was made famous because he kind of integrated Army and Navy units together, where, you know, before they even go into battle, they'd be bringing Navy, you know, companies and platoons on board to you know, teach them not only how to use the guns, but what's their language? You know, what are common things that are seen? Like, they need to speak the same language and be on the same page so that when these guys are raiding all out on land, you know, take out a pillbox, you know, they can speak directly to the LCI guys that they know. They know their capabilities. They kind of work in tandem together. And that was a big part of what LCIs began to do toward the end of the war, you know, with troop protection, with their big guns, but it's just more to the point where they really kind of trained them to be infantry guys. They weren't just sailors. Like, they had to be infantry also.
And just to avoid emails.
They were actually mortared. They fitted them with mortars. Did you know that, Don?
No, I did not. Go ahead and say that, because I stepped on it. Go ahead and say that.
Yeah, they fitted out many of these to be mortared gunboats. And they would have army crews come aboard and man these, and they would work with the sailors. And not to mention Saipan, where you're have these interpreters aboard, and you're going around trying to talk the people from killing themselves, and they're jumping off by the hundreds. And then the bodies are surfacing. Well, you can't leave. And so you wake up in the morning and you're just surrounded by all these floating families, and just by the hundreds, and they're decomposing, and they're being infested with flies and maggots. And then the flies, these giant black flies, would come out on the ships. And the guys said they were the type of flies that they would actually land on their face, and they would get in their mouth. And they are seeing these flies that are doing this, exiting from the bodies that are floating. Mm-hmm. And all of this is going on, right? This is visceral. This is up front. This is front line action that these guys are seeing. They're taking rifle rounds. They're getting hit with small arms fire. They're at Iwo Jima. As a matter of fact, Charlie Crandall, Lieutenant J.G. Crandall, he went around afterwards and he scooped up bags full of shrapnel and rifle rounds and machine gun bullets and this and that, because it was 2 days before the invasion. So it was his idea. He scooped it all up, and it just so happened that it was also bloody and full of human remains. But he scooped it all up, and they took it to the command ship, and he dumped it out on Blandy's table, Admiral Blandy, right in front of him. And the guys all just started digging through it. All right, what do the Japanese have? What are they letting loose with?
Battlefield intelligence. I have to say this, or otherwise we're going to get emails. People are going to be punching their phones. When I say close thing to Navy infantry, I think we must include the PT boats in that statement too, because those guys got down. Otherwise, people are like, hey, you left the PT guys out. They got down and dirty and up close in front as well. So the LCI and the PT boat guys were, you know, I think if you could almost do a Masters of the Air Band of Brothers S series between those two, because – When you do a 10-part miniseries, you got to spread it out. You wouldn't just want to do LCIs, but yeah, you could do LCIs, PT boats, and maybe something, include a little bit of submarine to get the three different faces, and you could clearly do a good series on that.
Oh, agreed. And you mentioned the PTs, and that's especially true. However, you know, with reading a bunch of material on how PTs operated, you know, at least PT guys, for the most part, they didn't live on their PT. The LCI guys lived on it. And, you know, imagine a PT having to spend years living on that.
Yeah.
And though it's a little bit smaller, it's like, it kind of just illustrates the point where it's like, can you imagine living on an ocean going vessel that like felt every wave for that long of time? Like how uncomfortable that would get. Like, because we're saying PT submarines, like at least for the most part, they got a lot of time on land.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you were getting supplies or something, you really didn't go on land, or unless you're one of the unlucky guys in the invasion to go down the ramp and having to set up the towing cable on the beach, which LCI guys did that too. It's like they really, for the most part, they got to be on land.
Can you describe that for folks who aren't aware of Omaha Beach? What would have happened?
Okay. So one of the things about LCIs is the two side ramps that they would deliver troops on. A lot of times, unlike LCBPs, you couldn't really get that close to the beach. Like you could hit the ground, but a lot of these guys would have to wade in water, you know, up to their chest, sometimes up to their shoulders. And when you're carrying equipment, it's really tough. And sometimes it's hard to see with debris, but Dennis mentioned Omaha Beach at D-Day. Some of these LCIs would go in when the beaches were not secure, and they would task one of their crew members, whoever that unlucky guy might be, and they basically give them a rope and a cable and say, okay, your job is you're going to be the first one off the LCI in this invasion. You're going to run down the ramps. You're going to be carrying this tow cable with you, and you're going to go to the beach and set it down as like a, almost like when you walk downstairs, like a banister to hold on to. Like the troops would hold on to the rope as they were, you know, kind of
waiting. And hold it.
Sure. And they would have to sit there and get shot at and hold this so that the rope was secure, so that these guys could empty off these infantry units Army Marines, they could come off of the ramps of the LCI and they could at least hold on to something so they didn't drown. So that was like the most like conceivably dangerous job I could ever think of. Like, it's just, yeah. So that's what Dennis was referring to.
Well, not to mention, because Dennis pointed this out, I think two episodes back, the early LCIs, you had those ramps coming down both sides, and then the later ones, the middle ramps. How long were those ramps? If anybody knows off the top of their head. I mean, looking at the photos, they look like they're at least 40, 50 feet long.
Yeah, they would have to be, because they were as long as the first, for sure, as long as the first third of the ship.
Now, imagine, if you will, if the LCI was in shallow, flat, smooth enough bank that it could sit flat, that those 50-foot ramps aren't oscillating up and down. They're actually standing still, running down those ramps with all your heavy gear, especially if you're a mortarman or a machine gun guy, while getting shot at, opposed to running down the 8.5-foot long ramp from a Higgins boat, which is wider, lower to the ground. I mean, those LCIs, you're up pretty high. You got that long pitch. The ramp is skinny as hell and super long. You just, the whole time, that had to seem like the longest run before you even got to the beach, just wanting to get off that damn thing.
That's such a great
like walking point. The plank, but diagonally. Yeah.
That's and Dennis can attest to this too. Is some of those earlier LCI designs, because they had two side ramps, in order to get the infantry or the Marines off of there, they all for the most part had to be up on deck, vulnerable out in the open. They had to be lined up in like single file on each side of the ship so that they could each one at a time run down the ramp. Like, I shouldn't say one at a time, but really the length of the ramp, you couldn't have two or three guys next to each other standing abreast running down. It was one behind the other single file line that was going down those ramps. And as you can imagine, if you're, you know, German Nazi artillery on the beach and you see that, you have a clear line of guys that are lined up evenly going down the ramp. So it's so,
and as you mentioned, all the way across the top, because as when
all the way across the top,
when Dennis
on both sides,
when Dennis pointed that out to me on that episode, I'm looking, I'm like, there's not even a piece of plywood. It's literally, they're standing next to a cable out in the mid open. No one thought to put some armor up there to hide them while they're waiting their turn to descend the ramp. No, they're just up there like they're up there like 12-year-olds at the public pool waiting for their turn to jump off the high dive. I mean, there's no protection from them. And as I was saying, that's if the thing is steady. Now, if you got mortar strikes coming in, they're not sitting. Now the boat's still on this. The ramps are going like that, and you're trying to go down. That's just training. You could train your ass off when it comes to the real thing. And obviously, once again, training, you don't have mortars coming in. You don't have artillery coming in. You don't have water splashing all over the boat. Real life thing, you got all these bullets, and now you're going down a slippery ass ramp in your boondockers that, you know, have a little bit of tread, but it's not like these things are covered in skateboard grip tape or, you know, slit steel. It's just have a couple of horizontal brackets and good luck.
That's very well said. And I can't emphasize this enough, is these LCIs, like you pointed out too, they didn't really have siding, steel sides. It was cables. Like, Dennis, where were you when you had that epiphany, when you realized LCIs, they didn't really have steel walls or banisters to hang onto. It's like, it's just cable that runs along the side. I don't know how more guys didn't fall off the side of LCIs while they were moving. Cause it's just, it's not like a steel wall that you could, or what have you, where you can lean up against it and, you know, you're protected. You can duck down if you get shot at on the side of the ship. The sides of the ship were completely exposed. Like, they had like a cable railing. It wasn't even like a steel railing. It was a cable that ran across. So it's like, that's all you had, was to hold on to this cable. And they're completely exposed from the front and the flanks on both sides. So it must have been terrifying.
It was like your uncle who's rich enough to live on a lake, but not rich enough to have the nice dock. Just has the dock that's attached to some 5-gallon plastic barrels he got from work. And then his wife made him run a little cable down just so somebody had something to hold on. That's basically what it was. You had a stranded cable and you're just standing up there until you start disembarking. And I've had the privilege of participating in the Peleliu event where I got to disembark from a landing craft. And I know how slippery that thing can be when it's, once again, that's only 8 feet long and wet. I've seen guys at that event, machine gunners, just fall and sink. So once again, these long ass wet ramps, bullets flying, the LCI listing and shaking, it's just, as you said, I'm surprised more guys didn't fall off the side and just, what is that, 15, 20 feet up at the highest point. Yeah. How high those crafts sit from the water
something
line.
Like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And fall into
and then don't
shallow
forget,
water.
You know, the waves were very turbulent there after D-Day, the Normandy. So it was a lot of those ramps were knocked off the track and were unusable. So they had to drop the ropes over the side in some cases, and the soldiers were just hand over hand, just dropping into the water, which was over their heads, and they were drowning. So they stopped and they tried to reverse, and it was just
not to mention people overlook this too when it comes to the infantry. Those guys are packed in there. You want to get the most cats upon a vessel that had the higher disembarking. Imagine sitting still. Go sit on your toilet for 3 hours, and then I say, hey, go run as fast as you can, carrying 80, 90 pounds of gear. Your legs are asleep. Maybe you've been sitting on someone's rifle for 3 hours. You've got pain. Your calves are swelling up. You've been sitting out in the sun. Maybe you're not as hydrated as we would like. Maybe we weren't up to date on things such as actic acid buildup that causes cramping and all these things. You know, these infantry guys have just been sitting there forever, and now run. Yep. Good luck.
Well, they were so seasick. They were very thankful for the opportunity to get off the ship.
Yeah, kind of like the airborne guys. Just get me the hell out of here.
Yeah. And John, even you were saying, even what's considered the easy part, once it's time to leave, like even that was tough. Like it's not as easy as it seems. It's slippery. Like there's things that can go wrong. So even what would be considered the easiest part was hard too. So, oh yeah, miserable experience on the way to the battlefield.
And sadly, with the design of those things, unlike an alligator in the future where you could, where the ramp drops down in the back, that wasn't an option. You were just kind of exactly. Like you're talking about on Save It Private Ryan, that ramp or those ramps go down and you're going face long into it. And it's just...
Exactly.
And
Zach, I wanted to ask you something. How did you personally get, if you were to advise researchers in the future and folks who want to write books about veterans and whatnot, how were you able to get these guys to tell you about the worst day of their life when they had gone a whole lifetime without telling their families?
It's a really good question. I've often asked myself that. I think a lot of it has to do with kind of what we alluded to earlier, is when you show up and you really have what comes off as a passion for learning these things, they really do tend to open up. And I think that, Dennis, you can speak to this too, is with our knowledge of World War II, we know the correct questions to ask. Like we know the right way to ask things and, you know, seeming genuinely curious, which we are. And it's not just, hey, you know, grandpa, dad, where were you in the war? It was, you know, when you can ask them specific questions about being at specific places, about their experience, they're more open to not only answer the question, but to recall funny stories that get them talking. And one little kind of life hack that I used for some of these guys that you could tell were reluctant to open up, even though they agreed to get interviewed, they still kind of were kind of closed off, is kind of one of the neat, useful tools that I used was I would play music from the time, and like Glenn Miller's In the Mood, you know, Artie Shaw, a lot of those, once they heard the tunes, they just started going, and oh, this song reminds me of, you know, a time I was, you know, and I know music can be helpful, but I really do think it has to do with, you know, people can tell, and with individuals that are out there that really have an interest in history, especially World War II, and you want to interview veterans about their experience, I would just say, yeah, just to show a genuine interest, which doesn't seem like that's probably going to be too hard for people that already want to do it. But yeah, asking the right questions, showing a genuine, you know, passion for doing it, because I mean, I know Don talked about in the beginning, it's just they loved seeing young people do this, because it's like, it's almost like you're making them relevant again. You're making them feel young again. You know, it's things like that that really are able to carry a conversation. So that's probably the advice that I would have.
The advice I would give, I've been privileged enough to interview 4 vets, and I'm actually going to go interview one here next month. And one of the things I'm planning on doing, to Zach's point, which I haven't done in the past, I don't know why, I guess maybe because I was too new to it, I didn't consider that, is I'm going to take some artifacts. I'm going to take a helmet, some uniform, some stuff to let them touch, feel, maybe to kickstart some of those old memories. Like, oh, wow, I can't remember.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But the two other things, particularly the one number one rule when it comes to veterans, I don't come at them with the who did you kill, what was the most horrible thing, none of that nonsense. I start most of them early, kickstart, you know, when did you enlist, do you remember these certain things? And then my personal thing that I've always done with this podcast, my other podcast, and a lot of times when I go to book a guest, particularly authors or people who kind of have a little bit of publicity behind them, oftentimes I'll get the, hey, can you send me a sample of your questions? And my answer is no, because I don't have any. I look at who they are. I brief myself on them, but I never write down questions because me personally, I find, and you'll see this a lot, I worked in radio for 6 years, and I would see this in other radio stations and particularly local news. I find personally that when the interviewer has 18, 20 questions, they'll ask question one, and while the interviewee is answering the question, they're not listening. They're next. They're waiting for them to stop talking so they can move on to question two. And so you get a very stilted, very boring interview. Whereas if you have ideas in your mind, maybe have some notes, and you ask the question, and you don't have that safety net, that means you have to listen to their answer in order to develop the next question. And so instead of having a stilted, very non-dynamic, static interview where you're just checking off question one, two, three, like you're doing a high school book report, now you have a dynamic interview, and depending on the interviewee and how cognitive they are, you can get things out of them that, A, you never anticipated on asking because you didn't know what they were doing, and B, they just came up with a memory that they haven't thought of in 75 years. And that one question may turn into a 20-minute, very in-depth answer. And that's the stuff you want. And furthermore, oftentimes, if you pre-write detailed questions, these are going to be questions that these guys have been asked 300 times over the last 80 years. And I find that makes for a more dynamic interview. And sometimes you'll have that, oh, I wish I would have asked this, that, and the other thing once you leave. But you can't get hung up on that.
That's exactly right. And Dennis, I would love to hear you answer that question. Like, because for those who don't know Dennis, a terrific job he did with helping Mitch Weiss, you know, research and write for another book called The Heart of Hell about the LCIs at Iwo Jima. He interviewed, I thought it was like close to 100 or more, you know, people or parties that were involved in that book. Like, what advice would you give for people that want to interview veterans?
Yeah, definitely. Especially folks who have seen death, there is a certain amount of they're tempered, right? And they can see through bull crap. They have no time for it. And the guys that died, they're not going to dishonor them by speaking their name to somebody who they don't feel really cares to know. So to Don's point, if you're asking a question and then glancing down and looking for your second question that you're going to ask and you're not paying attention, you're not going to get a great interview at all. And that's why it's important to record, because then you can ask and then forget. You can forget about your notepad. You can forget about looking down, and you can just be. You can be there as this just enthralled with what you're being asked. Of course, you can have questions down that kind of things that you really wanted to hit on. But that also lends to another point that it's really important to do follow-up interviews, because I can't tell you, I interviewed one of the guys in my grandpa's ship, Bill Hildebrand. I interviewed him over a dozen times. And sometimes it would just be a casual phone call, but I always recorded him. And Bill would tell me, he would laugh and he would say, I just feel like we're always talking about the same thing. I said, Dennis, I appreciate you calling. I love talking with you and chatting and catching up. But, you know, you really getting anything out of these? And I would say, Bill, the reason that I do was, one, I love chatting with you and catching up. But every time I call, you come up with another story that you had never told me before. And that is specifically why you need to be recording all of the interviews you do. You got to be real. You got to be prepared. You got to know the material. And you have to be respectful of what happened. And also, you have to have a certain amount of empathy, and you have to have kind of some really good gut instincts on. There are times when especially after you got real warm and you're in the flow of a conversation, there'll be some times where you've established rapport and then you can ask the tough question. Like, Charles, I know that your best friend, Ralph Owens, when they got hit on the Portside 40, I know he was your best friend. I know that he would read letters to you every night that he was going to send to his fiance. And I know that he died in your arms. If you don't mind, do you mind telling me about that? Right? And then you just get this amazing story. And but that all comes from people can see your heart. They can see if you're real legit, if you really care. And I think that above all else, Zach has got that in spades. And people can just see his heart. They see his passion. I mean, he took the LCI Item magazine. I was responsible for archiving the LCI archive. It was 14 pages, and the archive index was 14 pages, and I took it to like 150 something, 160 pages. And part of that job was to go through all the LC items, and the first ones were legitimately just an orange sheet of paper, like stark orange
Or bright
with
pink.
black, right, with red ink, and or a stark blue page. And then John Comer came along, and he took it and made it, and he elevated it into something that was just amazing. Multifold photos, very organized. And then Zach took over, and he took it to another whole level where the guys are just so impressed. But they see that heart, and they will open up. Yeah, they'll open up to you. And I wanted to ask you too, unless anybody's got a follow-up on that, I have another
I
question I
just
wanted
wanted
to
to
ask.
add to that, to what Dennis was saying. When you're interviewing these guys, and you let the conversation unfold in its natural rhythm, if they are the first one to broach those topics of conversation about someone taking a hit or seeing death, once they've kind of opened up that door, if you handle it gently, then there's nothing wrong with asking follow-up questions in that vicinity. But by no means do you want to come out, start your interview asking for the gory details
No
before they
way.
got to.
No way.
And
Yeah.
as time goes by, this audience, we're not going to have the ability, our listeners may decide to do a podcast one day where they're interviewing Korean War vets, Vietnam vets, as time goes by, Gulf War, Iraq War, etc. Just start the conversation, the questions off light, and see where it goes. And once again, if they start to broach those conversations because that's the way the timeline that they're telling goes, then just be gentle and understanding about it. And then just kind of, okay, well, he brought it up, so let's keep it going. But by no means you want to just, and as you guys are saying, their bullshit detector is real thin. They've been through this before. For all you know, they could have done many news paper interviews years ago where someone's trying to come out with gotcha questions and they just want the exploitive stuff. And these guys have possibly sworn off interviews for 20 years and now they decided to give you a go. And so you don't want to remind them why they stopped doing this to begin with.
And that's a great point. Just to add to that real quick, I should have made it sound like, if I made it sound like anything else, like it's a structured list of questions. Like,
No.
Don, you're right. Like, that's the best advice is it shouldn't really be like a formal interview structure. It should be like a conversational flow. And I can say, even if I came into some with like prepared questions that I
Yeah.
wanted to know the answer to, all of them ended up being just full conversation flows. And all the advice that both of you guys said was, it was really great advice. Like be gentle and be sensitive, put yourself in their shoes, try as best you can to try to understand where they're coming from. So absolutely. And I should mention, if you do have a list that you would like to ask a veteran, make sure, yeah, instead of any gory details, it's like some of my favorite questions to ask were, what was the funniest story that happened between you and your buddies? What was your most memorable experience? What was your favorite, CO or your commanding officer? What's one memorable story? What was your favorite Liberty type thing? Your
Did
time
you
off.
ever get away
Usually,
with anything in boot camp? Stuff like
yeah,
that.
like it's some of the best stories from my grandpa were the beer stealing stories when him and his buddies, snuck aboard to steal beer and got caught. So it's like, yeah, just more to that point, is you guys really nailed it with the approach
To
for
that
sure.
point, that was like one of my favorite chapters in A Helmet for My Pillows when Lecky was talking about at boot camp, how they would go down to the slop shoots, how they had literally just rows and rows of these pop-up beer stands, and how they would try to commando crawl on their back with a case of beer on their chest until the bar owner pulled a revolver out on them. Just the tomfoolery stories, because a lot of times we tend to forget, especially if you based a lot of your knowledge off of movies, particularly older movies. Guess what? Even the most recent movies, the actors are in their 20s and sometimes 30s portraying soldiers, where these cats are 17 and 18 years old. And so when you read stories like that, it reminds you, oh yeah, these are just, before they went to combat, these are just fucking kids, and they do what kids do. It's trying to steal beer out of some guy's bar in some dirt road somewhere. And those are the fun stories. And it reminds the vet of when they were younger too.
And exactly. I could say that when you do get them, this is something I really want you to, researchers and historians and writers, to really get this down, that if they are going to tell you about the dark day of their life, you're probably only going to get one shot at it, right? And so they may break down and they may get emotional. And this is from experience. And I'm going to tell you, you don't want to mess up this opportunity, because you're never going to get it again. So it's going to get super quiet and awkward, and it's going to get, your instinct is going to start kicking in, and it's going to start telling you to change a subject. But I'm telling you, give it like a good, solid, awkward 4 Mississippi count, and leave it on them to develop where it goes. Because I can't tell you how many times everything inside me was saying, move on, move on, move on, move on, yep. Right? Because being so emotional. But I fought against it through experience. And the next thing you know, they got their composure.
Yeah.
And they go deeper.
Yeah.
They go deeper in places. I got an interview from a guy who was on the 727 gunboat at Saipan. And that moment came, and I fought against everything within me that was telling me to change the subject and bail him out. And I fought against it. And then he started telling me about the bodies that were surfacing, and that they had become so numb to death and so scarred by everything they had seen, that some of the crew actually started fishing the bodies out and taking souvenirs off of them. And that some of the bodies they had would like cut off a leg, and they would take the meat off of the leg and stick it in a crate, and they're trying to get bones that they could take home for souvenirs, and it would stink up the whole ship from this rotting flesh. And that he talked about, then when he was sent home, then they were doing an out processing. They asked him about his experiences, and he asked if they could please send him back to the Pacific, because he was terrified to go home. He didn't know how he was going to talk to his family. I mean, I'm sitting there and I've never had a World War II veteran tell me about such things before. And it was all because I does that make sense? It's like, there's
does.
What would you say on that, Zach?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I'll even admit that was the hardest habit to break when I would interview the guys, is because the long pauses, everything in you is saying, okay, ask another, or fill in the space of awkward silence with a yeah or an okay, or, you know, even something like that to break it. That was the hardest habit to break. And I still have trouble sometimes dealing with awkward pauses, especially if you do give it the 4 Mississippi, and even after that they still don't say anything. And that was one thing that I'm glad I did when my grandpa was talking about his buddy who died. But, you know, I wish I would practice that more. And that's such a great piece of advice, is try to fight the urge to break in and break an awkward silence or a long pause, because like you said, Dennis, you'll be really glad that you kept that patience, because more often than not they will divulge into more detail.
Yeah, because during that moment they're mulling in their head if they value you enough to tell you about this most precious memory that is reserved for nobody. Gives me goosebumps to even say it. Nobody on the planet has ever heard that story from their mouth.
Yep.
And you've got them to the point where They see your sincerity, they see your heart, and they don't want this guy to go off to obscurity and never get mentioned again. And they know what your mission is to preserve that history. And so everything in them is saying, do I say it? And so that's what that long pause is all about. It's about them working it out, if they're going to trust you with it or not. And then you are a good person and you're trying to help them. So then you do exactly what I've done it too, Zach.
Yeah.
You do the awkward or you start fiddling around with papers and you miss a really good opportunity.
And to that point, you're unbeknownst to you, you're kind of put into a situation now where here's a vet who's paying you a tremendous service by giving you their time and their memories. But just for a split second, you can repay them by being their therapist, not saying anything, not suggesting anything, but just letting them talk and get that out of them. As Dennis said, it may have been something they've never told anybody. It may have been something they haven't talked about in 70 years. And as hurtful and as hard it is to see someone of that age and that strength breaking down like that, it can be therapeutic for them at the end of the day.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
To interrupt Definitely. That, with your next question, you're kind of breaking that relationship that you guys just built. And this is your way of kind of repaying them. Hey, this is my privilege to be here. You're doing a tremendous thing for me, but for a split second, by allowing you to say this stuff to me without me interrupting you and kind of creating this impromptu therapy session, that's kind of like how you can kind of slightly repay them. Just let them decide when to cut off.
Exactly. And I do want to mention before I forget, Dennis mentioned, you know, interviewing the same person, you know, half a dozen times. The guy we were referring to earlier, that vet with the kazoo, Royal Wetzel, I went through the same experience that Dennis went with his veterans that he interviewed. I interviewed Royal. I probably have like 10, 12 recordings of just me and Royal talking. Some of them were hour long BS conversations where he's not even talking about the war anymore. You know, he's talking about stuff, friends of his and stuff, but it's like, it always, if you're silent and you follow that advice, more often than not, they go back to what they were talking about. And even a funny, colorful character like Royal, he had those moments where, yeah, I felt like a therapist where I fought to say something and he dived deeper. And, you know, he told me the story about how the guy died in his arms, you know, from fiddling with the Japanese, what was it? It was a flare or something that he was right there when his buddy died and he held him in his arms. And, you know, it's just things like that. I know Royal. I know him when he was alive. He doesn't just go telling that story to people. That's a story that it took me years to cultivate the right conditions to be able to have him finally tell me that story. So, yeah, I had to mention that, Dennis, because you really
absolutely.
Reminded me of my experience with Royal when you talked about that.
The name of the book, When the Beaches Trembled, the incredible story of Steven Ganzenberger and the LCIs of World War II.
So jealous of that title.
368.
I'm so jealous of that title.
Isn't that a great title?
368 pages. How long was the original manuscript and how torturous was it to whittle that down to 368 pages?
Oh, gosh. Well, the full story isn't quite 368 pages. Like, a lot of that's the index and the notes and the sources and things like that, because there were so many interviews and so many things I wanted to put in the sources. But I'd say the main story is just shy of like 300 pages, about maybe 275. But you could pick it up on Amazon. You pick it up at Barnes & Noble. My social media handles, Instagram, TikTok, and all that stuff, you can get a hold of me if you're interested in learning more about LCIs. My handle is @Zach_editor, and that's Zach with an H. So if you do have interest in LCI history, you know, reach out to the podcast, reach out to me, reach out to Dennis. You know, we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, well, and to that point, Zach, maybe it's somebody, a historian whose story at an LCI is going to intersect with their story that they're pursuing, and they can broaden their story and make it more vibrant and fill it with more detail by getting a hold of you about maybe their something Solomon operations, and now you've got a contact for the LCI Flotilla 5 to make it that much better. You know, when we had the LCI archive dedicated at Fredericksburg, they contacted me and said that historians from the Naval Institute had specifically flown there afterwards to utilize the archive. So,
yep,
exactly. Yep, exactly. Sorry to interrupt you there.
And I hate to re-interrupt back, but I have to say thank you so much for all the kind things that you said earlier about the work that I did with the LC item and how much the vets appreciated that shot of for your words exactly. I remember that shot of adrenaline that I gave it, you know, starting back in 2014, that meant a lot when you said it at the time back 10 years ago, and it means a lot now. So thank you for saying all that.
I felt honored. And I'm just so thankful that I got to meet you all those years ago and that we got to rub shoulders with these amazing guys and their families, and Royal sending you and I birthday cards and Christmas cards and sticking a $20 bill in there, and, you know, John Roulette and Marvin Carpenter, Hal Blyle,
Eddie Benoit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All those great guys.
Amazing. We had that opportunity and we're very thankful for it. And we didn't waste it. We didn't waste that opportunity.
Exactly.
And we're preserved their stories. And I'll always be grateful for that.
Well said.
And I want to say thanks to everyone for your continued support of this show. And if you haven't done so, please head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. You can find all our social media links there. You can order merchandise like the K-Ration shirt I have on or the shirt that Dennis has on. Please sign up for a Patreon. It goes a long way to support what we do here at the podcast. We want to hear from you. Send us an email at mailcall@WTSPWorldWar2.com. For myself, Zach, and Dennis, we want to thank each and every one of you, and we will talk to you all next week.
This has been a Digital 410 production.